Yes, it was legal. It was their land. And afterwards, the Calumet, the CNH, bought out the Tamarack. And then it was all, and in the 1923, what they call the big consolidation, they bought a lot of those. They got Ameek and Alloway and Centennial and a lot of those other mines plus also.
The Ameek and Alloys and all those mines, have they been independent of
the they were independent before, yes.
Phoenix, that was long gone, huh?
Phoenix in Keweenaw County. I have history here, then after you want on Phoenix too. Of course, I can give it to you, but then they're the early mines.
Yeah.
And the first place where they ever sunk a shaft and the first mines and that, I got it here because... no.
Well, if you want to, did you prepare it?
Well, you want, now this would be...
If you have the, about the first mine, because...
Oh, okay, you want the first mine?
I had read recently that the first mine, I thought it was the, was it the Clark up by Copper Harbor? Was that the first?
Well, I'll tell you, I'll read it for you. Right away. The first known attempt at Lake Superior copper mining was made in the winter of 1770-1771 on what is now the Victoria property. The next work was done in 1849, was opened under the name of Cushion on a line of prehistoric pits containing masses of native copper. The name was changed in 1850 to Forest. And property was reorganized in 1858 as Victoria Mining Company. I'll give you now this here. At Hayes Point, Keweenaw County, December 5th, 1844, first mining shaft sunk, black oxide, Lake Superior Copper Company, first organized in the district, February 22nd, 1844. The Phoenix, formerly called Lake Superior Copper Company, mine occurs in the bed of Eagle River, about a mile above its mouth. This tract was among the first located in this region, and this company among the first to embark in mining adventures. The Lake Superior Copper Company was a few months older than the Cliff Mine. It was organized on February 24, 1844, and in August 1845, put in first milling plant in the district. Pittsburgh and Boston Copper Company, the Cliff Mine, discovered in the summer of 1845. Mining began in the fall of 1845, the first real successful mine. Well, then I got them. Well, then if you want others.
Do you have the Copper Falls?
Well, that comes, let's see.
Their sign up there that hangs by the road says something like 18. I don't know. I don't know what they regard as official, you know. But I think they're in the 1840s when they were first discovered. If I'm not mistaken, wasn't Horace Greeley, didn't he come to Eagle Harbor once?
I have his whole history there. If you want me, it probably won't take me a minute if you want me to dig it up.
Sure.
He had a abandoned shack. All right. Horace Greeley visited Copper County in 1847. Famed editor had interest in mining project. 6 miles from Eagle Harbor, there stood an abandoned shack occupied by Horace Greeley 83 years ago. That was in 1930. When he came to the Copper Country to see why a mine in which he held stock was swallowing fortunes instead of making them. The shack stood near the old central mine where Greeley fought heartbreaking fatigue and armies of mosquitoes on his first trek through the wilderness, and where he eventually buried his hopes of rich rewards and investors lost heavily. Greeley's mining stock was wished on him by an old backwoodsman named Bailey, who liked his editorials, requesting me. Greeley later wrote to act in his behalf as a trustee or director of said company, to which I, in my yet complete ignorance of mining, acceded. For some 3 years thereafter, I acted accordingly, coaxing several assessments from unwilling stockholders who, in their primeval innocence, had expected to receive dividends from their stock instead of paying assessments thereon, and applying the proceeds as well as I could to the opening of our mine. At length, in the spring of 1847, I made a business visit to our property, taking along the gold required to pay off our workmen, and buying at Detroit a yoke of oxen, a supply of hay and grain, a good stock of provisions, so forth, and taking them with me to their mine destination. After a hazardous voyage on the propeller, which had been brought from the lower lakes, they entered Eagle Harbor June 15, 1847, where, in default of piers, my oxen had to be pushed off the steamboat into the ice-cold water and compelled to swim ashore, my goods being taken off in a small boat. The next day, Greeley made his way through the dense woods to their location, 6 miles east of the harbor and 600 feet above it, where he paid off his men. With others, he then made a visit to other locations, a journey of about 20 miles in all, yet across such a succession of brooks, bogs, and other impediments that I unused these 16 years of walking more than an hour a day, was utterly flagged out and fell my full length repeatedly in the course of the last 2 miles. During the next few days, other locations were visited, and his party encountered dense and more ferocious clouds of mosquitoes and gnats than ever before or since presented me their bills, and insisted on immediate satisfaction, he wrote. I remember an instant in which several of us fled half a mile from their haunts to a hut, which we filled with a thick and with thick smoke, with very little abatement of their numbers or their appetite. But the nights, he wrote, even in midsummer, were so sharp that a mosquito seldom ventured to pursue his prey after sunset. Greeley's experience in baiting off the headland west of Eagle Harbor on a second visit was quite a disastrous. I went along to the headland west of Eagle Harbor, he wrote, on a bright summer noon when a fresh northern breeze was rolling in a very fair surf. I stripped and plunged in, but was driven out by a legion of infuriated hornets. No copper of any account had been mined in the region, except from the Pittsburgh and Boston or Cliff Mine at the time. Greeley was interested there. Shareholders, he said, who had raised their 10,000 to 50,000 in fond exploitation of early returns, found in time that every cent and generally more had been expended in constructing a rude pier, went on to their land, their supplies, cut a road, building a few rude shanties, drying up their tools, powder edibles, and so forth, and beginning to scratch the earth. Another and still another assessment being required, not to secure returns, but to sink a vein far enough to determine that they had any ore or metal to mine. By this time, they were ready to sell out for a song or abandon the enterprise. In despair and disgust, Greeley made but 2 visits to his copper interests. That's Greeley there.
You suppose when he told, when he said, go west, young man, he meant here?
I have read that too, that's one of his sayings that come here.
After that mosquito incident, I doubt if he meant here, huh?
Did you get that very clear and so
forth? Yeah, okay. Yeah. I never realized his role was that you know, that involved.
I got most anything you can think of, but I have so much that it has to be read. I got thousands of pages, you know, that you don't find it in books.
Yeah.
And that's how...
I've never heard that about Greeley before.
Oh,
that's amazing.
I spent thousands upon thousands of hours, to gather this information from the old papers, and then to write it and rewrite it and index it. So now, it's I have it all indexed, so I just pick it up and look at my index. Douglas Houghton was born in Troy, New York, September 21st, 1809. Graduated from Van Rensselaer School, New York, 1828. Soon appointed professor of chemistry and natural history in the same school. In 1830, he was appointed by General Cass and Major Whiting of Detroit to lecture on chemistry and geology in Detroit, thus bringing him to Michigan. Appointed surgeon and botanist for Schoolcraft's expedition to source of Mississippi in 1830. By Secretary of War. During the next 15 years, was elected mayor of Detroit twice and was offered the presidency of Michigan University before he was 30 years old. Appointed state geologist in 1837. As such, he made many discoveries concerning the mineral-bearing formations of the Upper Peninsula, and especially those of the copper-bearing series. On such an expedition, he lost his life while attempting to get to Eagle River in an open boat on October 13, 1845. His distinction lies in being the first scientific investigator of geological conditions in the Upper Peninsula.
Okay. Wanted to put, yeah.
The Calumet Mill at Calumet opened up in the spring of 1867, and the Hecla Mill at Lake Linden opened up later, the same year in 1867. Alexander Agassiz chose a site for the mill. Also had the railroad built for Calumet, from Calumet to Lake Linden. The mill had 22 stamps operating on conglomerate rock. The steam stamp was developed from the very crude and inefficient ball stamp of more than 100 years ago. The first ball stamp was used at Copper Falls Mine in 1855. Previous to that, all crushing had been done by means of the Cornish gravity stamps. Mr. Duffield and Mr. William B. Frew are among the first who suggested an acid process to save copper from being washed with water into the stamp sand, but never went beyond the talking stage, although a patent was applied for. Mr. Duffield, a chemistry student from Europe. Mr. William B. Frew was a mine superintendent. Reclamation treatment of waste sands. With every improvement in concentrating equipment and with the big stride made from 1900 to 1902, the possibility of treating old sands became more imminent. Mr. Alexander Agassiz had the idea in mind and inquired of Sir John Murray about a sounding machine for modern depths, say 20 to 30 to 100 fathoms, with a cup to collect a good lot of stuff from the bottom. Mr. Murray was connected with Challenger Expedition, exploring the ocean bottom. Mr. Agassiz said he would like to make a lot of soundings on our pile of tailings at Calumet for more than 30 years. As early as 1904, small quantities of sand were hauled down from the old Calumet mill at Calumet and treated on Wilfley tables. These tests demonstrated that further recovery was possible. The company had a full construction program in 1908. Regrinding unit consisted of 48 Chilean mills and pebble and ball mill. The crushing of the sands was considered simple to the necessity of dredging the sand from the lake. A dredge was purchased, plant in operation in year 1915. The reclamation plant was the result of the foresight of Alexander Agassiz. Dr. J.R. Van Pelt said the efficiency of this operation is one of the masterpieces of American metallurgical skill. It was due to the combined efforts of the Calumet and Hecla mechanical and metallurgical staff who added to accomplishment of other engineers their detailed knowledge of the specific problem to be solved. The ammonia leaching process added immeasurably to the financial success. The reclamation plant consists of a series of buildings adjoining the concentrator, situated along the shores of Torch Lake, the original site selected in 1866 for the stamp mill. It was a fortunate plan to have the stamp mill at Lake Linden. Had it been at Lake Superior, the tailings would have been washed away by the winter storms, or would have been contaminated by the barren lake sand. Torch is a series of inland lakes and in Kiwanis Peninsula. The stamp mill was erected on the shore of this lake with no other idea than to obtain an ample water supply and room for the accumulating tailings. There were two mills, one known as the Calumet and the other as the Hecla, and two separate tailing piles. The tailing piles covered an area more than 150 acres in depth, from zero at the shoreline to an extreme of 120 feet. The reclamation plant consists of five units, separately housed as follows. 1. A dredge. 2. Shore pumping plant and classifying house. 3. Regrinding plant. 4. Leaching and distillation plant. And 5. The flotation plant. The dredge will dig from a maximum depth of 113 feet below the water. By 1944, the dredge had reached the outer limit of the conglomerate sands. During World War II, the Osceola sands became a small asset. The profit from this reclamation plant carried the company through many lean years. For a 20-year period from 1925 to 1944, the cost averaged less than 6 cents per pound copper produced. The Calumet and Hecla also had a tamarack reclamation plant. The final figures when the conglomerate sands were thought to be exhausted in 1944 was production of 100,207,033 pounds of copper from 10,940,500 tons of sand. A patent on the Calumet and Hecla leaching process was issued to C.H. Benedict, Calumet and Hecla chief metallurgist, on March 16, 1915, but the original disclosure was in October 1912, and patent application dated April 18, 1914. A second patent was issued to C.H. Benedict and H.C. Kenny in 1920, covering improvements. The process is known as the ammonia leaching. The total profit of the Lake Linden sands throughout 1949 has actually been in excess of $30 million. So that covers that. Now, I don't know how much room you got, whether you want to take this short stuff or you want to go on that strike or what. See, the reason I took this because you got it mentioned in there that in your letter, and that's the reason.
Well, I can remember this. You don't, you know, the name. What I put that back. What I was wondering if you could comment about the smaller towns, such as Atlantic Mine and that sort of thing.
Huh?
What do most of the men in the Keweenaw now work at White Pine? Most of the guys that used to work in the mines.
Well, I would say that there's approximately 300 from former Calumet Hecla employees that are working at White Pine. I haven't got the actual figures. I read it in the paper, but I'm not too far away from it. It could be more or less.
How many men were working at the Calumet and Hecla mine when the last two shafts were open before they went on strike?
1,300 they had on the payroll.
Really?
Yes.
Did the company take care of those men when they closed down?
Well, some of them were eligible for pension.
And they got it?
And Social Security, and the older men took Social Security, and then those that weren't eligible, well, I suppose they're scattered around. Some may be working here, and I know some are working at Painesdale in a machine shop, and I know some are working at the Silitex Corporation, but the most of them are at White Pine.
And I suppose a lot of people have left, huh?
Yes, there has some left too, yes.
What was the union that they were affiliated with here?
United Steelworkers of America.
And on that subject, after this is a backwards way of getting to the subject of the Italian Hall thing, or the strike, but after the Western Federation of Miners were run out back in 1913, I read that they didn't come back to the Keweenaw for 30 years. Do you happen to know what it was that brought them back?
I really don't know what brought them back, but then they formed a union like in...
They did reform, huh?
In Calumet, yeah. And I think they had one in Painesdale also, see, or at Champion.
Do you happen to recall, when you worked in the mines, were you under the United Steelworkers then?
There was no union there.
Oh, there wasn't.
I left in 1938.
So the United Steelworkers must be recent, actually.
I don't recall just what year they came in. I imagine so. If I look up some of my records, I probably have it.
Oh, I was just thinking about that. Again, I'm going backwards, you know, toward this subject, but has anybody ever discovered who it was that was the cause of that Italian Hall disaster?
No. They had court proceedings and that, but they never could put their finger on who it was.
Yeah.
And why he called out fire. It's unknown. I can read if you have that.
Sure.
Here's the Italian Hall, and here's about that strike.
I know, the one thing I'm really interested in, I know pretty much the details of the strike.
Okay.
Except for one thing. Mr. Benedict doesn't mention, when he discusses that strike, he doesn't mention the Lehner steam drill. That steam drill, the Lehner?
Oh, that's an air drill.
Was it an air drill?
Air drill, yes.
It wasn't called a steam drill?
No, it's an air drill.
Oh.
I even worked on one of them, I know.
Well, according to Mr. Murdoch, in his book, he says that that was the cause of that strike.
Well, if you want to read it, I got it copied here from the... I believe it. This would give you a good idea. You just look at yourself and why the strike was caused. That's something different. That isn't Benedict's book. That's
it isn't?
No.
Do you want to read this?
Yes, that'll give you an idea.
Okay.
The following words that I will be reading are only some items of what I have read from a booklet which contains 87 pages concerning the Copper Country strike of year 1913. Quote, His Excellency Woodbridge N. Ferris, Governor of Michigan, Lansing, Michigan. Dear Sir, herewith the special committee appointed by the Copper Country Commercial Club to investigate strike conditions in the copper mining district of Michigan begs leave to present to you its report. This committee was appointed at a meeting of the Board of Directors of the Commercial Club held on the 13th day of September 1913 for purposes as stated in the following resolution, which was adopted at that time. Resolution. The Copper Country Commercial Club is an organization of 500 businessmen and others of Houghton and Keweenaw counties, whose purposes, as stated in the constitution of the club, are as follows. For upward of 7 weeks, a condition of affairs has existed and today exists in the copper country, which is nullifying every effort and every purpose of this organization. On July 23rd, 1913, the Western Federation of Miners called a general strike of all of its employees in the mines of this district. From the day of its inception, the strike has been attended with rioting and bloodshed. The National Guard was sent to the area by the governor at the request of the sheriff of Houghton County. The Commercial Club Board of Directors are as follows. Joseph W. Selden, president, Frederick K. Gook, secretary, W. R. Thompson, treasurer, Thomas W. Armstrong, J. P. Peterman, A. F. Heitkamp, Homer A. Gook, James John B. D., James T. Fisher. The committee is as follows: Edward Olsett, Henry L. Bayer, J. W. Black. The above men are supposed to be impartial, fair to all concerned, to seek out the truth concerning the strike. The union officials are as follows: C. E. Mahoney, Vice President of Western Federation of Miners. Local officials: Dan Sullivan, President. C. E. Hietala, Secretary. Keweenaw County population, 7,156. Houghton County population, 88,098. The union sent out the following notice to all mine managers: each demand of the employees, requesting shortening the workday, raising the wages, and making some changes in the working conditions, such as abolishing the one-man drill and to have two men working on a drill, an eight-hour workday, wages per day, trammers $3, miners $3.50. None of the nine mine managers replied to the notice. Violence occurred at Calumet and Copper Range towns. Mine managers will not recognize the union. No minimum wage applicable to all mines in the district can be established with justice to all parties concerned. The one-man drill has come to stay. The eight-hour workday ought to receive consideration of both men and operators, an adequate way of employees presenting grievances to mine managers without incurring the displeasure of mine bosses and underground discrimination, and possible discharge for making complaints. On July 23, 1913, there were 14,528 miners and 1,500 stamp mill and smelter workers, which were idle. August 15, 1913, mines again in operation. The Citizens Alliance were not mine operators or miners, but storekeepers, businessmen, and professional men, and office workers, unquote. But I have here how the strike ended up, unless you want to read all of this or just follow that.